From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how Michigan has shifted the cost of attending college onto students.
The availability of things like student loans and federal grant programs seem to make it easier to say we don't have to spend as much on the universities because there's other funding available to help people go to college if they want to.
Plus, have too many Detroiters become desensitized to failing schools?
The great thing about chartering is that it offers an opportunity to close down schools that aren't working. And I think more of that has to happen in Detroit.
And our long winter got us thinking of Laura Ingalls Wilder and her long winter of 1880.
And it really did start in October and end in April with very little respite in the middle for them.
What would Laura Ingalls Wilder do with the winter of 2014? Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us on this Wednesday. The sales of electric vehicles seem to be growing at a steady pace, and now EVs are selling at a faster rate than hybrids. Electric car charging stations are popping up across the country's highways and in the cities. Is it a fad, a trend, or a major shift for the car industry? We'll explore those questions on today's show. Then, more than half of Detroit's students are now enrolled in charter schools, and the traditional schools are still struggling to keep their doors open. So, with so many options in Detroit, how do we know the smarter choice? That story later in the hour. But first, it's almost hard to believe, but when it comes to funding for higher education, back in 2000, all but three of the 50 states contributed more per college student than each student paid. That came to a screeching halt in Michigan, beginning with deep cuts under the Granholm administration, cuts that got even deeper as the economy worsened. Today, Michigan's among the many states to shift the burden of paying for college onto students. We rank 40th in per-student higher education spending. Brian Smith wrote about this for MLive, and he joins us now. Welcome, Brian.
Hello.
So we see, as you know, we talk about the fact that Michigan has shifted that cost of college onto students since 2000. Is anyone the least bit surprised by this?
It really does seem that this is sort of a trend going on more nationwide. As you pointed out, in 2000, 47 states paid more than students did. Now it's about a 50-50 split. There are 26 states where students pay a larger share than the state does. In Michigan, that number changed not long after the year 2000. Governor Granholm made some cuts at that point, just sort of because it was necessary to take care of a budget shortfall. And since then, colleges have really been sort of trying to tighten their belts to get it back together. There's been some money put back in over the last few years here, and there's been more proposed for the next budget. But this is really sort of a nationwide trend that Michigan's certainly been a part of.
I'm wondering what has been the impact of this on the schools, especially in terms of the kinds of students they recruit. Are we seeing more out-of-state and international students coming in paying top dollar?
Certainly there has been more of a focus, at least some of your larger universities, toward bringing in more international students, more out-of-state students who are going to be paying those higher out-of-state and international tuition rates. A lot of the sort of absorption has been just there's a certain amount of money that it takes to run a university, and as the state support has gone down, you can look at the charts and see that tuition support has gone up. The latest figures from the President's Council, State Universities of Michigan, which is sort of the statewide group that combines all the state universities, says that about 80% of general fund appropriations for the state's universities come from tuition, and the remaining 20% is from state support at this point. And that's pretty much a complete flip from where it was around the year 2000.
That's very dramatic. I'm wondering, are we getting a sense that as the big schools are recruiting these international students or these top dollar out-of-state students, is that squeezing out in-state students of more modest means?
There has been sort of a lot of talk about how tuition can be kept under control generally. And, of course, Governor Snyder, the last few years, as money has been put back into higher education, sort of making up those cuts, mm-hmm. that's come with a lot of controls on tuition for in-state students, not raising it a certain amount. And if you talk to the universities, they'll say that they're trying to keep college affordable. They're trying to not put it out of reach of some of the lower-income students. Obviously, as the cost of tuition does go up, you have students who are maybe not able to bring as much to the table themselves who are having to go out and take out additional student loans and borrow more just to pay for the increasing cost of education.
And there's probably no way of knowing how many kids have given up their college dream because it's just too financially, it's out of reach.
It's difficult to figure that. There have been some studies that have sort of tried to look at that, but it's difficult to say just because that you don't necessarily have to say when you're leaving school why you're leaving school. And so somebody who doesn't finish a degree may be finishing it because they can't afford to continue, or it may be, for medical reasons or some other issue that they've decided not to finish their degree.
We're speaking with MLive writer Brian Smith about his report that finds Michigan is among the many states that have shifted the cost of college on to students. And I've got to imagine, Brian, that there are folks there out there making a case that says basically, okay, look, college hopeful, feel free to apply for college, but the burden to pay for this really should be on you, not the state's responsibility to carry most of your costs the way we used to. Are we hearing that tone in the conversation?
That has come up some, and something that the universities will say is that if you look at how they've been spending their money as state support has gone down, they've been putting larger and larger amounts of money into their own internal financial aid programs, trying to offer more money to students to help bring that cost down. If you look at over the last 10 years or so, the amount of money that it costs to educate a student adjusted for inflation, that number has not really changed all that much. It's just where that money's coming from. It's more and more the money that they're spending is coming from sort of tuition increases rather than state support, and a lot of money that they're spending is going towards increasing financial aid.
So as the cost of college is being shifted onto students, what I'm hearing you say is that the universities are looking for ways internally to kind of help out the students with that cost.
They certainly are, and as I mentioned, here in Michigan, there's been a push as state support has been ticking up slightly. It's been tied to limiting the amount that tuition can be increased. The percentage of money that the state gives is sort of indexed to if you keep your tuition increase below a certain percentage, then you get the full amount. And as you exceed that threshold, the amount that you get back from the state decreases.
Do you think, and maybe there's no way to really answer this question, but I'll throw it out there anyway. Do you think there's an appetite throughout Michigan amongst taxpayers to say, yes, we want some tax dollars to go back into higher education? And I mean a majority of taxpayers. Or could taxpayers argue we'd rather our dollars be used for the common good, let's say fix our crummy roads?
Well, if you go back and look at when these cuts were initially made under the Granholm administration, there was sort of a discussion about where do we want to make cuts first, which programs are we willing to sort of let take the hit to cover the things that we need to pay for. And the universities will say they didn't fare very well as the amount of money that was available for state programs decreased. There was sort of a consensus to put more money into roads, K-12 schools. Those are sort of the things that people prioritize because they seem to affect more people individually, because everyone drives on the roads. Most people have kids who are going to go to school,
right?
So they're going to be in K-12 schools, and college is sort of that next step. And the availability of things like student loans and federal grant programs like that seem to make it easier to say we don't have to spend as much on the universities because there's other funding available to help people go to college if they want to.
Well, Brian, we know Governor Snyder asked for that 6.1% increase to higher ed funding in his new budget, and the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Higher Education held budget hearings today. What happened, and what should we be watching for?
The hearing today was, again, the executive director of the President's Council, Mike Bolus, came in and testified sort of about some of the numbers that his organization has been looking at through the House Fiscal Agency and things like that. Basically, the number that we're looking at is they're about $750 million below where they were in fiscal year 2010-2011 if this budget recommendation is approved. So they're getting close to where they were, two or three years ago, but it's not quite there yet. and they're still looking at having to hold the line on tuition increases and stay below this 3.2% threshold that's been proposed. There are going to be some things that may influence that. I know the federal budget proposal that came out yesterday includes some additional money for federal Pell Grants, which sort of helps bring the lower-income students up in terms of how much they can contribute toward their education because they're going to be borrowing less in student loans. That may sort of help make things easier on universities in terms of how much financial aid they need to hand out. But, I mean, it's the funding is still not where it was a few years ago, and if you ask the universities, I'm sure they'd say it's not where they'd like for it to be. But it does seem that there is an appetite for at least some reinvestment in higher education.
I would only imagine that the university and colleges could only be thrilled to get that 50-50 split that we're seeing in other states.
That is sort of, I think, where the momentum is headed on their side, is they'd like for it to be sort of a 50-50 division between how much the state's contributing and how much students are asked to contribute. As you pointed out earlier, it's sort of an 80-20 split right now in terms of the burden on the students versus what the state's contributing. And, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that was very much swung the other way. And I think we're sort of trying to find an equilibrium between the two.
Brian Smith from MLive, good talking with you. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As our long, cold, snowy winter has dragged on, one result can be seen with stunning clarity from outer space. Satellite photos prove that the Great Lakes are nearly totally covered with ice, and we're close to setting a record for the most ice cover in 34 years. We wondered if we might actually break that record, and we wondered what this all means for the Great Lakes once spring finally finds us and that ice melts. Joining us now is Alan Steinman. He's director of the Annis Water Resources Institute at Grand Valley State University. Now, we saw that the most ice cover was 94.7%, and that was in 1979. So where are we at today?
Well, we're close to that. I haven't seen the actual data for today, but with the cold snap that we've had over the last couple of days, we're certainly creeping up. It's Lake Ontario that seems to be the most open right now, given the circulation patterns and the very relatively deep water of that lake, given its size. It tends to be the last to, it's a holdout in terms of icing over.
So it's keeping the Great Lakes from hitting that 100% mark then.
Indeed.
Now, is this good news for the Great Lakes?
Well, it is. Certainly the fact that the ice is covering the surface of the lake prevents evaporation, and that's one of the greatest losses of water that we experience in the Great Lakes. So the longer that the ice stays on the lake, the less chance there is for evaporation off of the surface. And as we have the cold waters, that coldness is retained by the lake water. And so as we go into the summer, chances are that it's not going to heat up as fast. And so going into next winter, we'll have a better chance of forming ice again and keeping the evaporation rates down. Now, there's no guarantee there. I mean, for all we know, we could have a very, very hot summer, and it could warm up again, and we could have high evaporation rates. But at least right now, given the high ice cover, given the cold temperatures of the lake, things look good, relatively good, certainly better than it's looked the last 20 years in terms of keeping the water levels up in the Great Lakes.
Yeah, in fact, I'm wondering then, as you say it's going to be colder, well, certainly swimmers that can expect it to be chilly, perhaps a little bit longer than usual. What does that mean for the biology of the lakes, or the ecology, if you will? Is it better for the water to be colder?
Well, it really depends on what kind of organism you're talking about, Cynthia. For some of the fish species, it might be problematic in terms of having the colder temperatures. Their metabolism may not warm up as quickly. For the algae, it probably doesn't make that big a difference. And actually, as we talk about, since you alluded to the beachgoers and the swimmers, chances are in the shallow waters along the lake shoreline, where there's not a lot of depth, water, if it's warm and the wind is not coming from onshore, chances are that things will warm up relatively quickly. And so what we're really experiencing is the colder temperatures in the deeper waters and out towards the middle of the lake. But if we have warm temperatures, calm winds, chances are that the beach conditions will still be relatively good.
Well, let's talk about what could we see, do you think, in terms of increased water levels in the lakes, which I'm sure boaters and property owners and also for agriculture and industries that depend on the waterways, they're always keeping an anxious eye on the fact that we've seen this trend 15 years or so of decreases. What do you think will happen?
Well, we have two factors that are going on simultaneously. One is the snowpack that's on the ground, and as that melts, obviously that will increase water levels in the lakes. And there, some modeling has been done as to what that means in terms of the water levels, and that might be anywhere from 3 to 8 inches of increase just associated with the snowpack. But simultaneously, as we talked about, we have that ice cover.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's going to be less evaporation that will keep water levels up. So the models are variable. They now, remember, typically, in an average year, water levels, at least in Lakes Michigan and Huron, between January and July, go up about 10 to 11 inches every year.
That's typical.
That's typical.
Okay.
And then they go down 11 inches going into the fall, into the next year.
Okay.
And that's why the water levels stay relatively stable. Now, of course, that varies from year to year. And over the last 20 years, we've had more declines than we've had increases. So will it go up above that 11 inches for this January through July of 2014? It very well could, given the ice pack, given the less evaporation. Models suggest the water levels could go up anywhere from 7 to 8 inches, which would be below normal, all the way up to 20 inches, which would get us close to the long-term average in Lakes Michigan and Huron.
Which I would suspect for commercial shipping, that's good news, because they take a big hit when they have to light load their vessels when water levels are too low.
Absolutely. Estimates are about $1 million for every inch that they have to do that. But it's not just commercial. It's also recreational boating. It's the local marinas. All of that benefit from higher water levels. There's less cost associated with dredging, and there's going to be more boating activity, so there's going to be more commerce in general. So in terms of the economy of the Great Lakes as a whole, it's a strong positive, as long as the water levels don't get so high, which is highly unlikely will happen, like we had back in 86,
right,
where real estate starts to be threatened again. The reality is, and we try and emphasize this quite often, that Mother Nature has the ultimate control over water levels in the Great Lakes. Humans can tweak around the edges, but when we have very cold spells and a lot of rain, like we had last April, water levels are going to go back up, and when we have long droughts, water level is going to go down. And, yeah, we can try and put control structures in there and spend billions and billions of dollars and potentially start thwarting with the ecology of the Great Lakes. But Mother Nature has a way of having the upper hand in the long run.
Alan Simon, director of the Annis Water Resources Institute at Grand Valley State University. Always love talking Great Lakes with you, Alan. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Cynthia.
How did Laura Ingalls Wilder describe the winter of 1880-1881, when blizzard after blizzard pounded her settlement town of Desmet in what was then Dakota Territory? Let's take a listen.
The constant beating of the winds against the house, the roaring, shrieking, howling of the storm made it hard even to think. It was possible only to wait for the storm to stop. All the time while they ground wheat, twisted hay, kept the fire burning in the stove, and huddled over it to thaw their chapped, numb hands and their itching, burning, chilblained feet, and while they chewed and swallowed the coarse bread, they were all waiting until the storm stopped. It did not stop during the third day or the third night. In the fourth morning, it was still blowing fiercely. "No sign of let-up," Pa said when he came in from the stable. "This is the worst yet."
Anyone who's read the Wilder books has probably been thinking of the long winter as we slog our way through our own record-setting winter. And that includes National Weather Service meteorologist and climatologist Barbara Mays Bousted, who's an aficionado of historical weather events. Barbara, good to have you on Stateside.
Hi, thank you.
We love the post you wrote for your blog that was called Wilder Weather. Can you tell us about that weather of 1880 that Laura wrote about in the long winter? I know they weren't keeping good weather data then, but how does it compare to what we're going through?
You know, it was kind of hard to find records, but there are a few out there. And from every record that we can find in the region, it really was as bad as she said. It was cold. It was snowy almost continuously for a good stretch of the winter. And it really did start in October and end in April with very little respite in the middle for them.
And I remember, because I devoured those books over and over again as a child, that the Ingalls family moved from their homestead into town because Pa realized it was going to be a doozy of a winter. And you kind of see how, as the winter got on and they were stuck inside and they're trying to grind the beans to make crummy coffee and twisting their hay to be able to have fuel and worried about getting food, people got kind of cranky and depressed. And I had to laugh when I realized that you recently had the winter extremity list, and Detroit topped the nation with the most miserable time of it for this miserable winter.
What Detroit did this winter, what they've done so far, is to top their own record, at least since 1950, of what we'd consider to be the most extreme winter in that time. They've had just a fierce amount of cold and a fierce amount of snow, and the combination has put them above their own record.
Yes, we know. We almost felt a little bit justified when we saw that list come out to go, yes, this has the most miserable, and we're the most miserable of anyone.
Well, I think they should feel justified there. It absolutely is the worst winter in most people's lifetime.
Well, you point out in your blog post that Laura Ingalls Wilder tended to use that expression 40 below a whole lot during her books, from Farmer Boy to The Long Winter to those happy golden years. Do you think was that poetic license, or did it really get that cold?
You know, I think 40 below has a nice ring to it. In the records that I've found, it's possible that they went to 40 below a couple of times. For the most part, when she said 40 below, it was really more like in the 20s to 30s below zero. But if you add a good plains wind on top of that, it certainly felt like 40 below, I'm sure.
You do tackle the question in your blog post, the Wilder Winter, WWLIWD, which stands for What Would Laura Ingalls Wilder Do? And, of course, knowing that we are sitting here in the Detroit area, having won the dubious honor of being number one on the most miserable winter list, can you share what you think Laura's top five ways of handling this winter would be?
Oh, sure, sure. You know, at this stage in the winter, I think they were just ready to get through and finish it. But
so are we.
I think we all are. At this point in the winter, I think a good top five is to keep your provisions handy when you've got a storm coming so that you don't have to go out in the cold and forage it. To keep your pets and livestock sheltered, and for most of us that's pets, but make sure they have a nice warm home. Laura brought the wood pile in the house in several of her stories, but we don't have to twist hay or do that for most of the time. Just make sure your heater is still working and make sure your carbon monoxide detectors have batteries and are checked.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us have a good amount of clothing to help out, but some of us are less fortunate, so if you've got an extra set of mittens or an extra blanket or sweater, maybe consider donating those to a shelter. It's been a long, cold winter, and there are a lot of people in need still.
Good point.
And if you have to go outside, dress in layers, cover up the exposed areas. We're still getting these below zero readings from time to time, and hopefully we're about to the end of them. But, don't forget that frostbite is frostbite. No matter how many below zero days we've had, it doesn't change the biology that causes frostbite.
True. And even if you don't get frostbite, you get those chilblains. Those aren't nice either. As we were all kind of going, what are chilblains? And we looked them up and we went, ew. So I know it's a pre-frostbite, but easy to get.
It's not friendly. And, one other thing Laura said a couple times in her books is, she bundle up and go out there on some of those cold days and just inhale deeply and, don't let the cold scare you and don't let it frighten you. Go out there and embrace it a little bit. And especially at this time of year, you can embrace the fact that it is almost over. Even the long winter ended in April. So
that's true. Finally,
we have a light at the end of the tunnel.
Spring finally came, and the grass did get green again, even in 1881 in Dakota Territory. So we can take heart with that. And you're right. Let's not be wimps, because if you read Farmer Boy, we can all remember Almanzo went out and went sledding on one of those 40 below days, too, didn't he?
He sure did. They went sleigh riding, too, when they were in DeSmet.
We will take heart and keep in mind WWLIWD, What Would Laura Ingalls Wilder Do? And we've been talking with National Weather Service meteorologist and climatologist Barbara Mays Bosted. Barbara, thank you so much. It's been really fun to talk to you.
Thank you. It's great to talk.
Think for just a moment about what you see when you get behind the wheel of your car. Everything from the padding on the dashboard to the thickness of the windshield is designed to help keep you alive in the event of a crash. That knowledge comes from experiments and crash tests, often conducted on crash test dummies. But whether we like to think about it or not, crash tests often are conducted on human cadavers. That's because engineers and designers need to know exactly what it takes to injure every major organ and bone in our bodies, and then try to design vehicles to protect us from those forces. The first place to ever conduct cadaver testing was Wayne State University in Detroit. Its bioengineering center has been studying impact biomechanics since 1939. We wanted to learn more about this research and what it means to our safety each time we get into a vehicle. We're joined now by Albert King, who's a distinguished professor in biomedical engineering at Wayne State. Pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you.
So can you give me an idea of, for example, something you might be working on right now, some kind of a research question that you're trying to answer right now doing this?
Well, you know, there's a rear seatbelt, airbag seatbelt that the Ford Motor Company has developed, and we're testing a second version of that for Ford Motor Company. It's an airbag that's attached to the shoulder belt, and that would act like an airbag when in a crash. It's mainly for elderly occupants who have weak ribs that will protect them.
Where do the cadavers come from, Dr. King?
Cadavers come from the donation program at the university med school. People sign up to donate their bodies for research after death. And so that's where most of the bodies come from.
Now, once you've used a cadaver in a test, what happens then?
We put all the parts together and turn it back to the morgue where they would cremate it.
Is there any way that there would be a way to estimate how many lives have been saved through the years because of the kind of work that you and other researchers are doing, including cadaver testing?
Well, many years ago, I made an estimate. I don't know if it's still true or not, but every cadaver test might save 12 lives or so, thereabouts.
Hmm. And when we think of the technology and the design in vehicles today, because of the work that you and other biomedical engineers are doing, these vehicles today are sure a lot safer than the ones that I remember from when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s. And I'm kind of wondering, where do you see your work taking the vehicles of the future in terms of safety? How crash-proof could we make our vehicles?
Well, it's up to a stage now where if you really want to walk away from every crash, you need to really make the car very expensive. So I think we're almost at the limit of what we can do in protecting people from injury in a crash. So the next step, of course, is active safety, where you try to avoid the crash, which is something that everybody's working on right now.
Dr. Albert King is a distinguished professor in biomedical engineering at Wayne State University. Thank you so much for talking with us, Dr. King.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Stateside. It's no secret that Detroit schools have been failing students for a long time. In 2009, Detroit's public schools racked up the worst scores in the history of the National Assessment of Educational Progress test, and scores haven't really improved since then. Charter schools were launched to offer Detroit parents a choice. But my next guest believes the unregulated environment for charter schools may have wound up hurting the kids who most need help and a sound education. Robin Lake is director of the Center on Reinventing Public Education. It's at the University of Washington in Seattle. She recently visited Detroit and walked away with some unsettling views of the condition of Detroit schools, both public and charter. Welcome, Robin.
Thanks, Cindy.
Well, your piece, A Tale of Two Charter Cities, on the CRPE website maintains most of Detroit's charter schools, in your words, are doing nothing to change the life trajectory of Detroit's children. Why do you say that?
Yeah, and let me first be clear that, you know, I think choice is not the issue in Detroit. Mostly, I think if we step back from Detroit's public school system, there are very few schools that are really high-performing. So choice is not the problem here. I think that the question is whether charter schools have really done all they can for the families in Detroit to change students' trajectories. The answer is no, not yet, but, you know, the question is how do you do choice right, not whether you do choice.
So you came to Detroit in January, and you were able to see the weaknesses in Michigan's wide-open policy when it comes to charter schools, weren't you?
I was, yeah. I mean, parents are struggling with the options. I think that ultimately parents are probably better off as a result of having so many choices. We heard heard from some parents who were feeling really empowered by having the opportunity to leave their neighborhood school, which was failing, and go to a different option. But I think that, you know, the challenge now is it's very confusing for families. There are so many different options, and it's very hard to navigate the system, both from the perspective of just getting information about which schools are performing well, but also finding transportation that's safe for their kids, navigating special education. So there are, you know, there are a lot of tricky elements going on in Detroit.
And Robin, as you talk to parents, give us a sense of some of the experiences that you heard about that, that kids are having in, as you talk about this explosion of charter schools. So how do you know which is a good one and which is not a good one? Which, what are some of the things you heard that bothered you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the problems right now in Detroit is there are so many schools that are fighting for families that are under-enrolled. There are probably too many charter schools right now in Detroit and too many schools. And so but a lot of parents are moving around from school to school just trying to find a good fit for their kids and just aren't finding that there are a lot of good opportunities in particular neighborhoods. And that, you know, some families talked about, you know, schools not having the capacity to serve kids with special needs or offering counseling services. And, you know, as you know, so many Detroit families are from such distressed backgrounds. They really need those supports, and they just weren't finding that they were there.
You also said you heard about schools that literally packed up and closed mid-year. Then what?
Yeah, yeah, and that, you know, this is good to point out that those schools were Detroit public schools. So again, you know, district schools are dealing with these same issues that charter schools are. It's just, it's a bit chaotic for families, and there's really, I think, not adequate safety net in place to help the most vulnerable families navigate those choices.
I'm speaking with Robin Lake, who's director of the Center on Reinventing Public Education at the University of Washington in Seattle. Robin recently visited Detroit and came away with a sense that, in a sense, there are too many charter schools, and how do you know whether or not they're really succeeding? And you can contrast that to the wide-open policy we have. It's unregulated in Michigan when it comes to charter schools. Contrast that to what you have there in Washington State.
Yeah, Washington State just passed its law this last year. It's a very cautious law in the sense that only eight schools are allowed to open each year, and there's a lot of screening and oversight of the schools. Maybe it's even too cautious, but we've tried to learn lessons from other states and take a pretty cautious approach, just at least in the beginning. And so, you know, Detroit, on the other hand, has had an explosion of choice. It's largely unmanaged right now. I wouldn't say it's unregulated.
Mm-hmm.
You do have charter authorizers, universities and colleges that are sponsoring schools and overseeing them. I think it's just a question of coordinating those folks and getting them on the same page.
But as you point out in your piece, A Tale of Two Charter Cities, that more and more of these charters are being approved by university and community college sponsors that you say operate outside the city, and they have little or no accountability for what they do.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that all government agencies should be accountable for the schools that they're authorizing, and they should be asked to either do it right or get out of the business.
What needs to happen, Robin, at a policy level, local or state, to regulate these school choice markets?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the great thing about chartering is that it offers an opportunity to close down schools that aren't working. And I think more of that has to happen in Detroit very quickly. And there are too many schools that are under-enrolled, aren't high-performing, and just need to be really closed and move on. There are so many schools around the country that are showing what charter schools have the capacity to be. It's time to take lessons from that and replicate those. That takes some effort from civic leaders in Detroit to reach out to those communities, bring them in, and make sure that they can operate really well. You do have some local nonprofits and foundations that are working hard on that front to attract national high-quality charter school providers and also help with parent information and safety nets and all that. You know, some things that the city could work on are transportation systems and safety systems so that as parents are trying to make their way through the choices that are available to them, they don't have to worry about those things. But I think it's also true that the people who care about rebuilding Detroit start paying attention to the quality of the schools and making it some of their highest priorities.
Robin Lake, Director of the Center on Reinventing Public Education at the University of Washington in Seattle. Robin, thank you for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
We've all heard the familiar idiom, every cloud has a silver lining. But when it comes to the healthy profits being earned by the Detroit automakers and the profit-sharing checks going to auto workers, my next guest makes the point the converse could also be true, that every silver lining has a cloud. Tom Walsh, Detroit Free Press business columnist. Welcome back to Stateside.
Well, you're painting me as a pessimist now. I'm going negative on everything. Oh,
well,
no.
Not so much negative, but there are challenges behind these great headlines. Chrysler's earned profit $1.8 billion and Ford's was $7.2 billion. So workers are going to see profit sharing checks. Everybody's happy. What's not to like?
Well, this is a tough business. Every business is a tough business, but the auto business is particularly cyclical. And we've had a nice run of several years of good profits and rebounding sales, hiring, adding shifts by all these companies in ways that, you know, we could not have imagined 5 years ago. I mean, people really wouldn't have given you a plug nickel that Chrysler would even still be here.
Yeah.
And now they're making billions of dollars of profits and sharing a lot of it with the workers. And it all looks good. Now, what happens next when we come to next year is a new round of bargaining the UAW contracts. Well, the last time they did this, obviously, you know, things were in pretty dire shape, and the government was owning some of the car companies, and the UAW didn't have hardly any clout in the last two contract negotiations.
Right.
And now veteran line workers haven't had an actual base pay raise in 10 years. They have gotten profit-sharing checks, and when things are good, that solves a lot of problems. But those aren't guaranteed in future years if things go in the tank.
Sure.
In the case of some of the lower-tier, newer hires that they're making, that profit-sharing at Ford, it can be like 25% of their annual pay.
Yeah, because they're getting the same amount, aren't they? We've got this two-tier wage system because of the near-death. So you've got those folks, everybody's getting the same amount.
Everybody gets the same amount of profit sharing. The new worker might be making barely half of the base wage of the old worker, but they all get the same level of profit sharing, assuming they work the same number of hours.
So it seems that there could be some resentments engendered on both with this two-tier system. You could see resentment on plant floors as people look at somebody on the line next to them making twice what he's making.
So you've had that built in. And then now the younger folks are, you know, there's been talk of, well, we should narrow the gap between the new hires and the old hires, and we should, you know, they should do something for us. A complicating factor in all of this is right to work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the unions aren't going away in our major auto companies, but, you know, right to work is basically saying no more closed shop. You can't force people to pay dues. Now, you know, I think the vast majority of the workers at the plants are probably paying their dues. But, you know, if they don't do anything for the lower paid workers and they're thinking, what am I paying dues for if I'm only going to get half the money and they're not reducing the gap here, I think there is some concern that the union leadership has to show that, you know, they're adding value for these workers. Otherwise, you know, will they stop paying dues or cut back? You know, there's a lot at stake here in these next round of negotiations. And both the UAW leadership, with Bob King leaving office, and at least, I think, two of the three vice presidents that will negotiate with the automakers will be different.
So they'll
be
green.
Side, as well as at the company side. So there'll be a lot of new people at the table.
Tom, it seems to me there'll be as much pressure on the UAW leaders from the rank and file to, you know, maybe get that raise in base pay or try to narrow that two-tier system as there will be on the auto companies to not fall back into the same practices or bad habits that got them on death row in the first place.
Well, exactly. Over many, many years, and it wasn't, you know, a lot of people blame the unions, but, you know, it took two to sign all those contracts. You know, they had boxed themselves into a situation where they were paying people, you know, no matter what the volume and price they were getting out of their cars was. So even if they were losing money and losing sales, they were still paying folks, and in most contracts giving them raises because they would get whipsawed. They didn't want to go down and let their competition keep producing. So what the crisis did was, you know, allowed the automakers to basically tailor production to meet demand, mm-hmm. to, you know, to give them the power to vary the size of the workforce and pay levels with more variable pay in terms of profit sharing to match the cycles. So they definitely don't want to go back to this huge fixed cost structure, and I think they'll dig in on some of this stuff. But it'll be interesting to see. They'll everybody would say, hey, you know, we all kind of, you know, hunkered down and did what we needed to do when our backs were to the wall, and we'll be smart about this. We'll see.
Keeping a long eye on those 2015 auto contract talks. Detroit Free Press business columnist Tom Walsh, thank you so much for talking with us, Tom.
All right, Cindy, take care.
Electric car charging stations are popping up across America's highways and in the cities. Is it a fad, a trend, or a major shift for the car industry? Stateside's partner with the BBC, reporter Theo Leggett, is at the Geneva Motor Show, and he's found most of the cars on display there are electric ones. So are electric cars about to go mainstream?
The Geneva Motor Show has always been about the fastest and the flashiest cars money can buy. Sure, there are plenty of ordinary shopping runabouts on display, but it is frankly quite hard to get too excited about those. But this is more like it. I'm on the Porsche stand and I'm sitting at the wheel of a Porsche Panamera, a gleaming silver sports car which looks as though it's doing 100 miles an hour even when it's standing still. And the really important thing about this car is it can travel for about 20 miles on battery power alone. Yes, it's electric, or partly electric. It's a hybrid. It does have a 3-litre petrol engine in the back as well. And sitting next to me is Wolfgang Hatz, who is Porsche's research director. And Wolfgang, why did you decide to make cars like this one?
We know our responsibility, and we have also big concerns about the environment. And this technology gives us the opportunity to fulfill all future requirements. We believe this is the future for at least the next 10 to 15 years.
A lot of people think hybrid cars are a little bit dull and boring. Just tell me, this car that we're sitting in, how fast can it go?
The top speed is 272 kilometers per hour. So it's really a high-speed car, and it's very much fun to drive and very performant.
What's happening at Porsche is very much a sign of the times. Car makers, even sports car makers, are under intense pressure to reduce both fuel consumption and emissions, and they're relying more and more on electric power to do it. Hybrids are now commonplace. Down at BMW, meanwhile, they've taken matters a step further.
At BMW i, we decided it was time to reinvent the car from the ground up, making sure we were open for truly innovative ideas. We decided that the car we wanted must be electric.
The German manufacturer has invested billions of dollars in its new i3, a neat little city car which has been built using space-age materials and which relies entirely on batteries. It's a huge step and a huge risk for a company which made its name producing luxury sports cars and bosses' barges. But according to marketing chief Ian Robertson, the time is right for electric cars.
If you went back over the last 3 years, the electric car market has multiplied by a factor of 25. So it's no doubt in our mind that it's coming, and it's coming quickly, and I think there is legislation which is supporting this in many cities around the world. So I think we are at a point where the offering is definitely living up to the expectation of the customer, and the legislative framework around it is very supportive of that. So I think we're going to see a lot of growth in this area.
And BMW isn't alone in thinking this way. Renault-Nissan has also invested heavily in electric power. Its stand here in Geneva is dominated by electric vehicles, from a tiny two-seater buggy called the Twizy to a battery version of its Kangoo delivery van. Vincent Carré is the man in charge of selling them.
We have already sold 40,000 units in the world, and with the alliance of Nissan, we have sold 140,000 units. So we know now the customers, and we are totally fully convinced today that electric car has a strong, strong place in the market.
Yet not so long ago, electric cars were widely seen as something of a joke. So what's changed? Why are mainstream manufacturers now pouring billions into developing new models? A question I put to Jay Nagley of automotive consultancy Redspy.
It's battery technology. People have been playing about with electric cars pretty well forever. You know, ever since the first oil crisis of 1973, people said, oh, battery vehicles are the future. but there was no way of powering them until lithium-ion batteries were developed for cars. But since they've been around for the last couple of years, it means finally there's the energy density that gives them the facility to drive a car. Before that, it just wasn't possible.
So, have we reached a tipping point? Are these newly potent electric cars about to whisper their near-silent way into the automotive mainstream? Well, perhaps we shouldn't get too carried away just yet. Sales of battery-powered cars still make up a tiny fraction of the global market, and petrol engines are currently a lot cheaper. But there's no doubt electric cars are being taken seriously now. And in a few years' time, who knows? Perhaps at shows like this one, old-fashioned petrol cars will be the exception rather than the rule.
And that was the BBC's Theo Leggett. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Bob Scan. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.